Today I'd like to welcome Chris Bailey. Chris Bailey is an investment industry veteran of over 20 years. Chris also founded Financial Orbit Limited, which is a financial consultancy which provides investment research globally. Chris can also be found on Share Radio on a regular basis. And Chris and I have conversed and discussed shares on Twitter now for over 2 years. Hello, Chris, and how are you today?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Great to be here.
Now, Chris, we've spoken at large about numerous topics on Twitter. Today, what I'm trying to do is to enable some of our listeners to just grasp some of the learnings that you've had in your 20 years in the industry and your personal viewpoint on investing, your strategies, and your learning and your journey so far. Is that okay?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Delighted to share a few thoughts.
Thank you very much. So welcome to LSE Share Talks Conquers Corner. I'm going to start my first question really, Chris, and that is your background and how you got started, etc.
It's a long story, but I'll condense it to save the listeners. So essentially, when I think back my early inspiration, I'm going to surprise a few people here, plus at this sort of age myself, it was actually TVAM, which many people recall as some sort of slightly down at heel breakfast TV show. And they had this sort of interesting city kind of news. It was done by this guy in a sort of a pinstripe suit, and something about it captured my interest. And before I knew where I was taking my parents' copy of the Daily Mail, and I was doing this weird thing of looking at all these numbers and share prices, and I started kind of following a few of them, just basically by interesting sounding names. Anyway, roll on a few years, and at school we got the opportunity to study economics, and suddenly all of these bits of information and knowledge and ideas, it all came together. And I guess everybody has a subject at school that they can do effortlessly or just really enjoy. And for me, it was economics. So invariably that led to university, an undergraduate, and then a master's course in finance and investment. And at that point, I knew that I just wanted to be all around the investment industry. It had everything that interested me, not just sort of high finance, but analysis and stories, and it was global. There was something you could add as an individual too. So anyway, I got my various university degrees and whatever, and I came out into the big wide world, and there was one major problem. There were no jobs. And so I had to actually start at a fund of hedge funds, which basically selected hedge funds for very wealthy people. And essentially, it was actually, by pure luck, the best thing going, because I got the opportunity aged in my early 20s to run around the world speaking to people who were far more intelligent and knowledgeable about investments than I ever was, and talk about different strategies and issues and challenges. And basically, it was the best MBA course you could ever have without actually doing an MBA. And I did that for 3 years and learned a huge amount, got my professional industry exams, and then finally managed to move myself into the fully fledged investment industry, working initially at a long short European hedge fund, which again was fascinating as an analyst, yeah. Building up my knowledge base before finally becoming a fund manager. And at the ripe old age, well, by my mid 30s, managing a team with around about 2 billion of funds under management. And it was great. And I achieved everything I wanted to achieve: performance, insight. I felt I ticked all the boxes. And then I realized, as is often the case when you do some really interesting things, that actually I'd achieved everything. There was nothing left to really challenge me, and all the good things I liked about investment, I was no longer finding. And so I did the thing which people talk about a lot but often never do, and that is I quit. I realized when I looked at people 10 or 15 years older than me, you know, senior professionals in the investment industry, all they did was have meetings, and they weren't enjoying it anymore. And so I stepped out, I founded Financial Orbit, and the rest, I guess, is history. Because the wonderful thing about investments is it's alive, it's dynamic, and you've got to have that opportunity to really embrace it and sort of feel it fully. And it's that the last 3 years since I launched Financial Orbit have been have taken me on many different adventures, many different directions, and I've really rediscovered my love for global investing, and also my love for not having meetings. So, you know, it's in essence, I highly encourage everybody to do this. It's obviously something which you have to be slightly prudent and imprudent about simultaneously. Yeah, yeah. But ultimately, if you're not, investments is something to be enjoyed. There is the serious side to it, performance and other matters. But if you're not inherently enjoying it within one environment, then step out to another.
Chris, that is an absolutely fabulous story. I mean, the thing that staggers me about it most is that you managed to have done all of that within a 15-year time frame. So you've gone from being a student to running your own company, and firm with colleagues, and then you've decided, you know what, a bit like the monk that sold his Ferrari, it's like, I've had enough now. I want to actually enjoy my life and do far more with it.
Yeah, maybe, but for me, actually, it was an acknowledgement that the world is changing.
Yeah.
And people listening to this think, oh my God, you know, there's a whole load of city institutions and highly paid analysts and related. Yeah. They're going to know a myriad of million things more than I will. And the answer is they don't. Right. And this is what people have got to sort of get over, this kind of this intellectual, you know, sort of snobbery barrier, if you like.
Yeah.
The reality is, individuals in today's world are in a wonderfully strong position. The big difference between today and when I started is the provision of information.
Yes.
And this is actually what inspired me in a way to start Financial Orbit, because I realized that you don't need to be part of a big city company with all of those, positives, of course, but some negatives as well. The, you know, blocked up meeting schedule and all the other factors, when you can get access now to that company, economic and various other bits of information you need to make quality investment decisions off your own back. And it, for it actually not to cost you very much money, if any money at all, to access it. And the real, I've realized my value add, if there is any, is in the interpretation and analysis. It wasn't in sort of gathering the information, because that can be done in, as I say, in a myriad of other ways. But the trouble is, when you're part of a big company, you as an individual, your value add and related can be, it can be negated by the corporate brand name and everything else. And if you really want to passionately feel that you're pushing yourself to the limit, to the extremity, you're getting better and stronger, then you have to go out to some extent on a limb by yourself. And this may surprise a few people. As you say, I did thick end of 15 years in various institutional environments.
Yeah.
I can honestly say the period of time I've learned the most about investments, and I'm not talking about the silly things like, you know, whether I've, did well in investments or not, performance and related. I'm talking about core information to allow me to make hopefully good investment decisions. That period of time when I've learned the most, with the exception probably of my first 3 or 4 years in the industry, has been the last 3 years. And that's because you strip away that corporate environment, you strip away all of those constraints on your thinking and everything else, and you step out by yourself and you enter that information flow and everything else. It's a wonderfully inspiring environment. And people listening thinking, I can't do this. This is too complex for me. I say to them that you can do it. You've just got to find that area, that style, that part of the investment universe or your portfolio requirement, which just suits your setup, your background, your time availability and related.
Are you there, Chris?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, Chris, that's absolutely brilliant what you've just said there, because essentially that is what we're trying to do at LSE Share Talk. We're trying to make it a level playing field for everybody, you know, because we have got that that essence where the information's out there, and companies now are being more forthcoming. They're using social media. They're sharing the information, not waiting 3 months, 6 months, a year to come back to the shareholders and tell them the relevant information as to whether this is a good investment time or not. So I think it's absolutely exhilarating and refreshing what you're sharing there, and the fact that anyone could step out on their own and fear can be good. you know, and you're obviously exhilarated by it and you're still enjoying it now.
Yeah, I enjoy it more now than when I was, you know, notionally managing a lot more money, to be honest, getting paid certainly a lot more money than I earn at the moment. But
yeah.
it's not about earning this or managing that. It's about enjoying it. And if you're not enjoying something, this applies way beyond investments.
Yeah.
If you're not enjoying it, then 3, 6, whatever months down the track, you're not going to enjoy everything else that comes with it. And so, yeah, you've got to enjoy it. And the financial markets are difficult. They're not easy.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, there are a few things as interesting, stimulating, and potentially sort of a huge contributor to your net worth than doing things like managing your own pension fund or having a say on the investments that make up some of your net worth. To me, it's at many levels, it's a fascinating thing to do. And I think hopefully for many people listening, they're thinking, yeah, actually, you know, I can make a difference. So I do want to get more involved in my own pension fund or my own management of investments. And the good news is in today's world, they can.
They can. I completely agree. So given what you've learned now and you've shared with our listeners, if there was one thing now, Chris, that you would change, what would it be regarding the investment environment?
So I think the big thing is people owning up to mistakes. And I see far too much spin and miscommunication. The trouble of, I wouldn't call it a perfect information backdrop out there, but of plentiful information, let's call it that, is that there is this veneer of spin. And you see it, I would say to anybody, look at the regulatory statements that come out every day. You know, 7 o'clock, all the companies come out with their news and views, etc.
Yes.
And it annoys me when I see companies saying things like a good start to the year or a solid start to the year. You scroll down to paragraph 15 and they've slipped in a little profits warning. Now, to me, that's the one negative of this world that we live in, where there's so many things trying to capture our attention.
Yes.
They feel they have to sort of hide things under the carpet or spin them appropriately. Yeah. And, you know, this is not just small companies. The largest companies in the land are just as guilty. In fact, you know, in many ways, because they have a myriad of advisors and everything else, no doubt sensibly remunerated, they're almost past masters at it. And that's the one thing which, you know, for me, I hope I can look through it. I've made the mistakes. I've seen, you know, too many war stories and issues around it, not get fooled by it too much. But I know that there'll be people out there listening who kind of look at a statement and think, well, this sounds good.
Mm.
And then maybe invest money or maybe think about buying the shares. And then are surprised when something somewhat different happens. And this is what annoys me. I believe that the authorities need to say, look, you've got to either be clearer in your views or at least, I think actually what the best companies do is that they give very tangible and clear targets for the next quarter, the next year, as relevant for their business.
Yeah.
And they keep on going back to them. And if they hit them or not, they say it.
Yeah.
And this is, for me, as an investor, somebody who's trying to look at credibility of stories, this is so helpful. And I'm sure people with different backgrounds and slightly less experience in investment markets would love to see companies coming back to tangible targets and actually saying, did we hit them or not? Because sometimes not hitting them is not a disaster if you explain it and say why and relate it. But too many companies, they're too afraid of doing that. That's what I'd like to change. Clarity of communication and also responsibility. People have got to realize that they're putting out statements. This matters for people's investment choices, pension funds and related. And you don't need a PhD in sort of interpretive dynamics of language to understand whether it's good news or bad news.
No, I would completely agree with that. I was reading something a little while back, and there was a piece of research by Exeter University going back to the 2000s, and they found that the greatest share price slumps tend to follow profit warnings that didn't tell investors how much profits would fall by. So that psychology of we're not quite sure what this information is and what's actually going on with the company was worse than actually being blatant and telling them exactly this is how much we're going to lose, this is how bad things really are, and being honest with the shareholders and investors. So I completely agree with you there, Chris.
People get rewarded. Share prices get rewarded. And people, companies that have a good record of communicating and are clear and work with investors, funny enough, their shares do better. You know, it's in a way, investment and the financial markets can be quite simple. You know, you try your best, you hopefully do a good job, you spot some interesting themes. And if you're rewarded, if they, broadly speaking, come off, you're going to probably see a share price that does okay, or at least keeps in line with some kind of general broader indicator. It's when people try mistruths and related. And as I say, this is not a pop of small companies. Actually, this is as relevant for the largest companies in the land.
No, I agree with you. So given that, as an investor, how would you describe yourself? You go through, you do your filters, you do your checks. You decide to purchase a particular stock. Are you low risk, cautious, long term? How would you say your strategy is?
So for me, I'm opportunistic. Would be in a word. I would say half my investments are longer term, and by longer term I mean holding periods of well over a year, and in some cases multiple years. And the other half of my investments are a bit more opportunistic. Because I observe that sometimes the best opportunities can come, particularly over sort of a 3 to 9 month period where a company is changing and perceptions are changing. I like to describe my style as one where I'm looking for anomalies. Because essentially, my view is, as an individual investor, you cannot influence a share price. You just don't have the power or anything else. Great, so what you've got to look for is, what do you see that Mr. Market doesn't? And by Mr. Market, I mean the totality of the market.
Yeah.
And when you see something that excites you, that ticks your boxes, you think on your criteria, whatever's important to you, that actually this is something which is undervalued, and which importantly, Mr. Market will evolve their view over time because of XYZ reasons. That's what gets me excited. This sort of idea of anomalies. Now, inevitably, you know, to use another great Benjamin Graham expression, you know, the market is a voting machine in the short term and a weighing machine in the longer term.
Yeah.
And I like it when you have that confluence of low sentiment, but actually an underlying reality which is better than people think. That to me is a wonderful combination. And what tends to happen is over perhaps a 6 to 9 month period, that may reverse. You know, suddenly the next trading update or IMS statement or whatever it might be is a bit better. You get a few more believers, and then you get the next interim statements or full year statement, which is clearly a new trend has been established, or something hasn't been as problematic as people think. So I think half my investing is like that. Half is much more inherently what I would call longer term, where we're holding periods of probably in the 12 months plus region. And what I'm looking for there is quite simple. It's looking for companies who thematically are doing interesting things. And that actually doesn't mean that that sounds as if I'm going to start talking about some massive growth theme or something like that. It isn't. That can clearly fit into that criteria. But for me, it's companies where there is either high visibility of earnings, good progression of cash flow generation, and or dividends, something which actually over the fullness of time, I believe in the thematic direction the company is moving in. And my perception would be it's going to add value over time. And we all know that the biggest or most important rule everybody learns in investment is that the power of compounding is absolutely amazing. And, you know, sort of a big lesson I've learned, I guess, something I would do slightly differently than perhaps 15 or 20 years ago would be to ensure that I had half my portfolio in compounders, which would form, if you like, a bedrock, and then have my more opportunistic plays, which inevitably will entail a little bit more risk and a sort of a perception of a turnaround or a change, which of course may or may not happen, for the other half. And I think always, if we're not careful, we chase that exciting shorter term story.
Yes.
As I said, this doesn't need to be small caps. This can be large caps as well.
Yes, plenty
of volatility in the FTSE 100, I can tell you.
especially the start of this year, yeah.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, mining stocks are a great example indeed. But, you know, it's having that balance. For me, what's important I learned very early on, and it's interesting you mentioned the University of Exeter, because I did study there, did my master's course there.
Okay.
And I remember one of the lecturers there in one of the early first term, first week, sort of saying something on the lines of, earnings can be manipulated, cash flow is much harder to fiddle with. And they are absolutely right. And again, we're coming back to sort of reporting and clarity of reporting.
Yeah.
You know, I of course I read the front page of a statement, of an RNS statement, but you know, I love to dig into the middle bit. And the bit that always gets me most excited tends to be centered on things like cash flow, because that tends to be a bit more tangible. You get a feel. And it's very true that far too many of the corporate problem stories, you could have seen something was a bit amiss in the cash flow statement way before it turned up in the earnings per share or the company commentary.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the unfortunately, though, as you've reiterated a few times there, Chris, is that the vast majority of investors look only at the headline. So they only look at the first two paragraphs. And I personally made that same mistake when I started out, only reading the first paragraphs and missing out the essential information way down, further down the RNS, and then wondering why the stock hasn't moved in the direction I thought it would. So you have to dig down to the minutiae to actually find out what's actually truly going on. And if that's cash flow, then cash flow invariably could be king.
That's right. And I would say it's an art, not a science, in the sense that, you know, I know some people who start at the end of the statement and work backwards and stuff like that. There's all sorts of ways you can cut and dice it. It's an art, not a science. You do need to interpret what's being told to you. And unfortunately, that also includes having a feel for what Mr. Market thinks about the share today, i.e. is the company well-loved? You know, you can get that combination of events where you have a perfectly reasonable statement at face value, but a share sells off because it's all in the price.
Yes.
And again, you know, that's for novice investors, even for experienced investors, that's a tough one, trying to work out what the average person thinks, you know, a sensible price for that share is. And this is why ultimately I come back to things like cash flow or dividend payments, or if you like, a sort of a thematic perception of where a company's earnings capability could be over the next year or two. Because you know, I always do a few numbers myself. I'm not a huge numbers person. Of course, you know, I know my way around the balance sheet and everything else, but one of my early bosses, you know, talked a lot about the importance of being able to put numbers on the back of an envelope and do that whole back of the envelope sanity check on valuation.
Yeah.
And mating that with the sort of the qualitative appraisal of kind of if a company was doing sensible things, whether the industry they were in was a positive one, et cetera, et cetera. And this is very much morphed into my approach too. I look at the aforementioned cash flow. I look at things like EBITA, so earnings before interest, tax, and amortization, et cetera. But ultimately, do I spend a lot of time thinking about things like discounted cash flows and related? The answer is no, because a small change in one variable throws things out and leads you to a myriad of conclusions. Far better to get a feel for just the general valuation space a company resides in, and then start thinking, okay, so where could it go next year or the year after? Under sort of common sense, where do you think it is going to go assumptions? And then working out whether you are happy paying the prevailing market multiple for that or not. And for me, it's that sort of artistic element of investment is just as important as the, if you like, the more overt scientific one.
Okay, so Chris, when you say that, do you also compare the individual companies that you're looking at against their peers nationally and globally?
The answer is yes. I mean,
okay.
The original rationale for me becoming a global investor, I was schooled in European investment. And about a decade ago, I started looking at US and Asian and other areas of companies. And the rationale for that was quite simple, because I thought, hang on, take a sector like oil or mining. You know, these companies are inherently global. So if you're doing some work on, I don't know, BP, let's say, then to take a look at ExxonMobil or Petrobras or PetroChina or whatever is not that difficult. And actually, I think that applies generally. And in the end, during the sort of the last 5 years of my institutional life, they were the mandates that primarily I ran. What I would global thematic, comparing essentially the sort of the strapline, the marketing strapline I came up with, was something on the lines of looking for the best companies and the best themes in the world. And that meant that you could find an interesting theme in one country where it was actually fully valued, but in another country it wasn't. And we had some interesting success with that. Now, of course, people are probably listening to this and thinking, oh my God, you know, think of all these checks and balances I've got to do before making an investment.
Yeah.
And of course, in an ideal world, you would say, right, before I'm going to buy this share, I'm going to check out the peers here and there and compare valuations and everything else. And of course, that is useful, but it's just another bit of information. I would say start small. Look at the company itself. Does it make sense to you? Are the numbers to your liking, the valuation? Is the company's tone of commentary, does that make sense to you? When you listen to the conference call, for example, do you get things out of that? Do you get that good feeling or not? And this, as I say, is why individuals can make great investors, why you can manage your own pension fund.
Agreed,
because actually that, if there's one bit of advice I'd say is do your own work. Just get, when you buy into a story, when you listen to the conference call, go that little bit further than just looking at, God forbid, a broker's note or even the regulatory statements, you know, some primary insights. Actually, listening to the conference call, which again is now, they're hugely available, free phone numbers and everything else, or replays on company websites, very easy to access. Do you get that good feeling when they answer questions or talk about the company? Does it make sense to you? Do you trust them? There's a very famous study, I forget who did it, but essentially a very experienced investor had a new intern or inexperienced investor join their team. And he said, spend the first 6 months going to company meetings, as many as you like. I don't want to know what they say. I just want to know whether you inherently trust them or not. Come back, review which ones you liked and didn't like. And then we'll review it at 6 and 12 months. And what was amazing was that the companies on average that outperformed, many more were the ones that were perceived to be trustworthy. So by doing things like listening to conference calls, you can get so many more insights than just a sort of a bald reading of a regulatory statement, or as I say, just taking those sometimes very marketing led sort of secondary sources like broker notes or tip sheets or whatever else.
That's very, very insightful there, Chris. Appreciate that. Thank you for sharing. One of the concerns I've always had really is that there is an element of mass psychology within markets, and that element of trust, once it's lost, the herd will just all bolt for the door and take companies, you know, down, if that's strong enough word. What are your thoughts on the herd mentality of the markets?
Yeah, it happens, but this is why the market is a voting machine in the short term. Flows matter. It's a supply-demand game at its broadest level. But for me, I'm not a natural contrarian, but I'm somebody who is opportunistic.
Yeah.
And when you see an anomaly where something is clearly perceived in, generally it's an overly negative fashion, it can be an overly positive fashion as well.
Yes, it can.
Of course, I remember very well the dot-com boom, and we can have many interesting stories about the herd mentality moving the other way.
Yeah.
But this is why I think it's important you need to do your own work. You need to get comfortable with numbers as they are today, or company commentary as it is today. Yeah. So I would say you've got to take account of the herd, because it matters in the shorter term. And the shorter your investment time horizon, the more it matters. Now, given I'm certainly not a day trader, and probably I'm at the most thinking about months. And as I say, for a good portion of my portfolio, years, I look for opportunities from the herd mentality. And my view is the way I find comfort is not by saying, oh, they're wrong. No, you've got to get a bit deeper than that. You've got to say, okay, they're wrong because of this. Oh, and by the way, the shares in the company are trading at this level or that level, and or it's exhibiting this level of dividend yield or cash flow, and therefore that's going to support the share. So you've got a bit of quant, you've got a little bit of numbers working to your favor, you've got some kind of different view, which you think ultimately the market will come back to your view of, actually this wasn't quite as bad as we thought, the prevailing themes aren't quite as negative as we thought. So as I say, this is a little bit of fusion of a few numbers and sort of qualitative interpretive insights. You put those together and some of those herd situations can be wonderfully opportunistic. So in fact, actually, I think from a purely, if you like, efficient use of capital basis, they're probably the most interesting areas of the market. Because of course, as I say, when you get that difference between perceptions and reality, that's when profits tend to follow.
Yeah, they can create great catalysts, can't they? So Chris, going back a little bit, looking at all your investment portfolios being 100%, what would you say your allocations are across FTSE 100, funds, all share, global stocks, etc.?
Yes. So I'm a pretty much exclusively equity investor.
Yeah.
I don't really invest in funds. Often I hold a little bit of cash, of course, opportunistically, depending on market levels. But if we assume on invested capital, it will be something on the lines of 50% in the UK, and that they will be predominantly in FTSE 350 stocks. Occasionally the odd small cap comes in, but predominantly FTSE 350,
yeah.
And 50% globally, ex-UK, probably the largest buckets are in inevitably North America and the States. Then it would be continental Europe. And I've also got some direct investments in Asia too, mainstream markets like Hong Kong, Singapore, and related. So, you know, I am a global investor, inevitably, if you're based in the UK, there's a natural home bias. Number one, you're closer to companies, news flow, as I say, even mid-cap regulatory updates. But second, you know, the London market is a wonderfully international market, and you get fabulous de facto international exposure because of the underlying earnings base of these companies. So, you know, if there was only one place I could choose to invest from in the world and only invest in one market, it would be the London market. You're not going to get bored. You can pretty much do a bundle of stuff in it. And it's obviously helpful from a time zone perspective, as you can imagine.
Yes, it is.
Given my global orientation
days
can get lengthy because, you know, I all the things I was saying about conference calls and everything else, you know, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but English has become the de facto business language of the world. And, you know, you will often find me picking up akin sort of insights I've talked about for kind of UK companies, doing exactly the same thing, listening to an American conference call, a conference call from a continental European company or an Asian company. All the same things apply. And I say, this is the marvelous thing about today's world. When I started, honestly, true story, as I said, I started off as a European investor, i.e. UK plus continental Europe. And in the latter, one of the big hindrances was getting an English translation of things like statements and annual reports or quarterly updates or whatever. You know, Italian companies did it in Italian lira, et cetera, et cetera. And people have different views about the Eurozone and everything else. But all I can say is, thank God it's down to a handful of currencies. And as I say, English is the de facto business language, better or worse. And it's the same in Asia, and obviously America's always been a bit more accessible. But this is the wonderful thing. If you wish to pursue opportunities there and you can see anomalies and opportunities, you can now do that through a variety of sensible intermediaries and executing brokerage firms, which is great. And the information is there to be tapped. You know, company websites are woefully underused by investors. So much interesting information on there, even if it's linked just to the regulatory statements and webcasts and everything else. As I say, key is do your own work. It doesn't matter whether you're investing in London, in New York, Sao Paulo, Beijing, wherever. All the same rules apply.
I think, as you know, Chris, I mentor several individuals via DMs and over the phone and et cetera. What I find, though, is that there's a recurring theme with some of the people that I mentor, and I hear it all the while on Twitter, is that I don't have time. I don't have time to research, so therefore I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I keep saying to them, look, your research is essential because you can't find out the information that you need to make a qualified decision. What you're actually doing is listening to the noise of the market, and that's leading you to make your decision. So this importance of research can't be lost, and I'm glad you've hammered that nail in again today.
And the thing is, if you're a day trader, all you care about is flow and short-term movements.
Yeah.
And I agree, it's just watching the tape, or however you want to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
If you are an investor, and by that I mean somebody who's investing, therefore, for months and years,
yes,
and you, therefore, are not turning your portfolio that aggressively, you're probably not holding hundreds of stocks, you've probably got, you know, fair concentration, a fair spread, but nevertheless a fair concentration. It is such a sort of a short-sighted thing not to put in necessary hours to read statements and keep up to date. And the wonderful thing is technology helps you.
Helps you.
You know, I'm not going to give shout outs to various sites, but there are plenty of sites out there where you can put in your portfolio tickers and it will send you the regulatory updates.
Yes.
Now, how wonderful is that?
Yes,
it comes direct to your inbox. Now, of course, you're going to get a whole load of rubbish sort of direct to buy sales, but they can be quite insightful as well.
Yeah.
But in terms of, there is no excuse that, you know, you're not seeing the flow. The information, it used to be hard to get. It isn't anymore. In fact, the problem is too much information.
Yeah.
But that's why, because there is too much noise out there. And that's why if you are an investor, in my opinion, looking to invest over months and years, cut out as much of the secondary stuff as you can. Focus on the primary stuff first.
Agreed.
And by primary, I mean regulatory updates, company webcasts, stuff from the company, or, you know, broader economic releases by governments and statistical organizations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Real sort of the kind of the facts, if you like, which obviously have a lot of chat and everything else around them. Once you've taken a look at that, then maybe blend it with some secondary sources. It's useful to know what the market's saying, what they're feeling, how they're looking at things, etc. That's useful. But if I had a choice, if I had to choose between primary and secondary, always choose the primary.
Agreed.
Do that first. And how long does it take? Let's say, I don't know, let's say you've got a 50 stock portfolio. That I'd say most people have a smaller portfolio than that, but let's say you have 50 stocks. How many times a year does a company say something interesting in terms of regulatory update? Well, I doubt whether it's going to be, let's say 10 times, make the maths easy. Probably it's going to be less than that, but let's say 10 times. So you've got notionally 500 bits of information to process. Well, I can tell you, while some of those will be lengthy and necessarily complex, and maybe have conference calls or webcasts attached to them or presentation documents, you've got 365 days a year. I can honestly tell you, if you dedicated 1 hour a day to your investments, you would cover all of those things quite happily and have a really good feel for that kind of underlying sort of insight. So an hour a day to do something as important as managing your investments with huge implications for your longer term wealth, pension size and related, I think that's pretty good. I know people spend an hour a day doing all sorts of other stuff, which probably doesn't have as many positive attributes, maybe more enjoyable.
Right? Yeah, long term.
There you go. So if you're serious about this, and you know it's a serious business managing money and making investments, and you can't afford, let's say, an hour a day, or maybe you've got a 25 stock portfolio, maybe it's half an hour a day, then you should probably think about mutual funds and related. There are some good ones out there. That's probably a more attractive option for you. You know, you'll get a better risk reward equation on your ultimate investment portfolio performance. But if you like investing money and you want to spend a bit of time doing it, you don't need to spend eons of time. Get the technology to help you, and it will be fine. And what you'll do is you'll start to enjoy it, and then you'll turn into somebody like me, who quite happily spend multiple hours. I'm not going to say how long. It's probably easy to say what hours I sleep rather than because the trouble is then you start saying, well, you know, why don't I look at this company and why don't I look at that company? And before you know it, you know, the whole day's gone. But you know, for me, as I said, the last 3 years have been a revelation because for the first time in a long time, my meeting schedule has been massively suppressed. And of course, we all know that the greatest impediment, even for professional investors, to actually doing any investing is meetings, mindless meetings. So the wonderful suppressing of that has meant that for the first time in a decade, I've managed to actually properly look to the extent I want to look. I've never listened to so many conference calls, never flicked through so many presentations, but actually the trade-off, the payoff has been fantastically positive. And that's for me, you know, a gnarled old veteran of whatever it is now, 20 odd years. Just think about somebody with a little bit less experience, coming from a lower knowledge base, just what a massive difference that can make to you. It's an absolute essential. I can't stress do your own research more. You can hear me ramble on about shares or other people with insights. That's great. That may be helpful. But it's only when you buy in, you know the reasons why. And also, should really emphasize this as well, write it down.
Yeah.
Write down. It doesn't need to be War and Peace. All it needs to be is 6 bullet points, why you like something. And it can just be tone of management good. They said this, they said that. It can be ultra simple bullet point style. Write it down and go back to it.
Yeah, that's good.
I can't emphasize that. For me, I love writing, and I've always been able to make investment decisions as a consequence of writing essays on it. For me, when I'm thinking through results, working out the interesting things, that's my brain processing the information, and at the end, the decision pops out. That's how I wrote investment research, the institutional world. Pathetically, I still do that now, but yeah. It's good because now I can look back and say, Chris, you're an idiot. You thought that, and that's and that's why you've got to adjust your valuation there. Yeah. Is it still good or bad? Mm-hmm. So that's the good aspect of a bit of institutional insight. In the, if you like, the more private client world or individual world, 6 or 7 bullet points, and every time there's a statement, go back to it, update it, write another couple of things. Yeah. It's not complex. You do that, I can't say I guarantee you get better decisions because there is other elements and other factors involved.
Yeah,
but
agreed.
I would say you'll feel much more comfortable and confident about what you're doing. I think you'll enjoy it more, and I hope very much you'll get a better outcome.
That's really, really insightful, Chris. I would agree with that sentiment because I've advised people to keep diaries in the past and keep looking back regarding why they purchased the stock. And I, to be perfectly honest with you, I only started doing that myself personally about 4 or 5 years ago. And when I started doing that, I used to think, well, that's changed. And when they said this in the last statement, that's now changed. So if it's a positive or negative, you've got to balance it out to see whether or not you wish to continue with that particular investment. So it does work. So I would also recommend that. So, Chris, I'm going to ask you a couple more questions before we finish. I think I might have the answer to this one already, but what has been your wisest investment decision to date?
So I guess, all right, there's the obvious stock answer, which is, the investing in yourself, but moving beyond sort of that kind of intellectual property statement. In terms of actual shares, I would highlight 3 for differing reasons.
Okay.
The first, in terms of absolute return, nothing can beat the wonderfully named Geo Interactive Media back in the .com days. It's an interesting story, which I'll bore the listeners with for about half a minute. Okay. But essentially, this is fascinating. A friend of mine highlighted to me the attributes of this company, which clearly was very growth centred. I bought at £1. I sold half at £2, so taking out my base capital.
Yeah,
And then, which is always a sensible thing to do. Another top tip, in my opinion. And then ultimately, it peaked at something like £30.
Wow.
I was taking money out all along the way.
Yeah.
And I was and in the inevitable descent, I sold my last tranche of stock at £18. It was a wonderful winner, etc. My friend who told me initially about it traded the stock aggressively and I actually made a small loss on it during the whole of that period.
Wow,
but that's
okay.
Another story. So that's the sort of the dot-com wonder story in proportional gains. The reality is you get very few shares like that in your lifetime. The 2 shares I'd highlight as being the most successful investments for me over a sustained period of time. Because as I say, I tend to invest sometimes for months, but try to do for years. It's inevitably the power of compounding again, which has made some of the latter trades, the latter duration trades, the most compelling. And interestingly, perhaps some people may draw some kind of interpretations from this. One's in the gold space and one's in the tobacco space. So, quite those 2 attributes. I don't know whether they're saying something about the sort of longer term investment successes, but there you go. The gold one is a well-known company, FTSE 100 company, wasn't when I invested. Initially called Rangold Resources, which I think is a wonderful company at many levels. But ultimately also, it's a company who I would highlight as a gold standard, no pun intended, on certain aspects of corporate honesty. Yeah. And if I would say, if you want to find a company where you listen to the chief executive and you buy the story off the clarity and passion of his words, then Mark Bristow at Rango Resources should be the first one you listen to. You know, I'm sure there are even better companies in other sectors doing wonderful things out there. But if you can tap, if you find CEOs that have that mixture of clarity, humility, insight and passion, then you should always buy shares in those companies, because I would reckon on average you'll do pretty well. So, and obviously gold, they've been successful, highly successful. The gold price obviously moved around quite a lot over time, but it's because of their organic successes that's been a good investment. You know, whether gold's done.
How long have you held Rand Gold?
So, I've been a holder of Rand Gold now, since, I think it's, 2006.
Wow.
So it's about a decade.
Yes.
And, it's more from being, a minnow, a mid-cap at best, into a company which is now one of the largest gold companies in the world, at a time when many of its peers have been, you know, very disappointing, shall we say. And I'd say the exogenous factor, like the gold price, has moved around all over the place. Their shares have massively outperformed peers and the underlying commodity.
Yeah, I think also a factor there with Randgold is that they're not laden with debt, and they're one of the lowest cost producers as well, aren't they?
Precisely. And this is when you think about rationale for investments, you know, each, and I am a pan market investor, there's no sector I won't look at. Of course, if I don't understand it or don't feel as if I understand it, I won't invest. So some of the sort of the slightly more excitable esoteric areas I do give a miss to. But, you know, I understand the notions of mining, and I can see the macro, and you're absolutely right. You know, the real positive for this company is a very simple story. It's low cash product, low cost production, production growth, and a vision of generating cash even at relatively low gold prices. And for them, they only build mines when they can get double digit return at $1,000 a troy ounce gold price. And obviously, that is a prudent assumption, which means they actually don't make various investments, which could be marginally interesting, but actually it's such prudence that stood them in good stead. So there's been some luck there, you know, in terms of their findings and mines and developments, but it all stems from a good management team knowing what they're doing. So that's one. The other one at the sort of complete sort of polar opposite spectrum is actually Imperial Tobacco. And Imperial Tobacco has been a company, again, I've held for a number of years, and one which has rewarded me handsomely over that time. And it's interesting, I'm not a smoker. It's never appealed to me as a biz, as a hobby or lifestyle or whatever else.
Yeah.
But as an investment, and obviously I understand some people have some moral issues and whatever, fair enough. I personally don't. But as an investment, I found that if there's one attribute that you should look for in many sort of consumer-facing businesses, or even manufacturing as well, is one of pricing power. Pricing always is to be preferred over volume per se. It's funny, earlier today I was looking at I mentioned the name, it's Carlsberg, a Danish beverage company people may be familiar with. They had some numbers out, and the volumes were negative, and so people think, my God, you know, they're not growing, that's not very good, etc. But actually, you look underneath, the prices were going up, and you know, good business models focus on pricing power, not volume growth per se. Obviously, great if you can get both, but if you've got to choose between the two, pricing is key. And I can't think at this moment in time of a better industry or an industry that has such sustained pricing power, because obviously of its underlying addictive substance, let's face it, as tobacco. So Imperial Tobacco has been a great medium-term compounder for me. And again, you know, I've always had the view that there's, and this is where some of the global analysis comes in, having having done things my institutional life, including going to the extremely smoky headquarters of companies like Japan Tobacco, or you know, having the opportunity to speak with the management of a company like Philip Morris International, who sell malt around the world. You know, there's one deal left in the tobacco industry, and I've often wondered whether Imperial would be involved in that in some shape or form, probably as a as potentially a target, or maybe as a company to pick up pieces from any divestments from that final deal.
So it has been talked about for many, many years. It's like a perennial takeover, and it hasn't happened yet. And I think maybe that's because of the levels of litigation that are still ongoing in numerous parts of the world. And there's just, you know, concerns about, is there more to come? Is it over with yet? But I think invariably it will happen.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a concern. I think also that Imperial have, they've done their own big deal. They merged with a company called Antardis, which was a Spanish-French big tobacco name as well. So they've done their own deals, and they've also very successfully bought brands and from other deals that have required divestments.
Yeah.
So they've seen ways around to kind of continue growing. But ultimately, the combination of brands, pricing power, and again, a very straightforward management team. Again, what I like, and this is not just true of the current CEO, but the one prior to her, very straightforward. And maybe it's something about the tobacco industry, but I find when I listen to the conference calls of Altria's and Philip Morris in the States, or Imperial Bats here, they're always very straightforward. There's lot less of this sort of kind of chatting around, which you often get with big consumer name companies, and they're very straightforward and to the point and related, and that's very refreshing. So again, that's been a very powerful compounder for me over a number of years. In fact, I'm trying to think when I made my initial purchase. I think it was in the dog days of 2008. I took the view that the first place to start rebuilding portfolio exposures was in something extremely defensive, and then as confidence started to rebuild, you can move more cyclical. So I think I made at least my initial purchases in my current position then.
Okay, I think statistically as well, Chris, in agreement with you, is that the tobacco industry and the components of that globally have outperformed every other sector over the past 25 to 30 years as well. So with dividends as well, it's you know, massively outperformed every sector.
Yeah. And I think it's back to what we talked about right at the start of this conversation, which is the difference between perception and reality. Now, I'm old enough to remember back at, I remember the infamous FT column, which talked about, he talked about a groundbreaking Time Warner AOL deal, which was supposed to be the high point of this whole new economy. And what was really fascinating about that report, it was in the Lex column, was that next to it, or in sort of embedded in the report, was, you know, some excitable looking technology valuations and share prices. And next to it was a whole load of tobacco company valuations looking very sick and tired. Mm-hmm. And that was a height of perception. Now, not only was the dot-com boom brilliant, but old economy tobacco was heavily litigated. You can be regulated to hell. Yeah. And it was an absolute disaster investment. And of course, that perfectly touched and highlighted the turning point when you should have been selling every single tech company you own and buying every single tobacco company you own. Now, we're at a more sensible point now where there are still some overvalued tech companies, but there are some interesting ones, and tobacco companies are certainly more firmly valued than they ever used to be. But it is when you can spot those regime shifts, those changes of perception, they are, okay, I'm going to make a sort of slightly bold statement here. They are seriously pension fund value accruing potentially for you. And my guess is in the typical investor's life of, I don't know, two or three generations, let's say, you're only going to get, there's going to be some times where there is just such, there is a ball that is just aching to be hit out of the stadium. And that was one of them. And every few years, something like that comes along. And it always comes about because of dislocation and very negative, often negative, but sometimes positive perception. And, you know, we saw elements of it in 2008, 2009, that very apocalyptic view of the markets, rightly or wrongly, clearly on the basis of the last 6 or 7 years, wrongly, you know, there's another story and another debate about where we're going over the next 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you get those opportunities, if you can try and capture them, you can make such a massive difference to your portfolio valuation. Of course, the skill is in that timing. It is waiting for that opportunity when that perception and reality differential is so compelling that you just have to do it.
Yeah, and then obviously the second skill, obviously, is the timing again in the way of staying with that particular stock, you know, for 3, 5, 10, 15 years. Because unfortunately, with some people, you know, and I've been the same, is that you make 25, 35, 100%, and you're like, well, I've done well here. And then you sell out and you're watching it continue to climb. You're thinking, oh, no, I wish I'd kept some of that. So it's better to top slice and keep a little percentage and de-risk than to cut out altogether.
Absolutely. And ultimately, good companies compound. And
yeah.
Compounding is the most powerful concept in finance, rightly. Yes, you've got to be aware of valuation and the story. And this is why doing a few numbers, keeping a few notes is important. So, you keep up to date with your thinking on a company based on its valuation and performance today. But ultimately, this is why I split my pension fund into approximately 50% of, you know, what I would regard as proper pension fund holdings,
yeah.
Which are companies I like on a multi-year basis. And essentially, I'm looking more for an opportunity to augment my position, i.e. add more on weakness than necessarily kicking it out because of some short-term gain. Obviously, there are when the story changes or when the valuation does get a bit too fruity for me, then I will get the top slice throughout or in some cases move on because you've only got a limited pool of capital, of course. But by keeping that sort of 50-50 view, what I would call 50% opportunistic, 50% strategic, That works for me. Different people have different splits,
yeah.
Depending on your preference and your time availability. But that works for me. But I would absolutely concur. It does at least allow a little bit of discipline that some of those medium-term compounders. And let's not forget, the major attraction strategically of equities is the fact that you're cut into the dynamic and evolving and innovative cycle out there. It's funny, when I think about from a big picture perspective, think about asset allocation and choices between different investment classes. If you exclude property, because I'll include that as a residential home,
yeah.
But if you think about investments that you make, the great advantage of equities over bonds is that today, amazingly, they yield a lot more on average. But second, it's not a fixed principal investment. You've got more risk, but you've got exposure to growth and change. And you know, the world is a funny place. There are certain issues out there at the moment, strategic and macroeconomic. But ultimately, I'm an optimist in the sense that I do ultimately believe that the world will grow. I see the population growing. I see people wanting to get more wealthy. Capitalism in various guises is generally a good thing, certainly better than the other systems. So, you know, you put all of that together and you want to be exposed to those medium to longer term trends. What better way to do it than through some sensible companies with good brand positions or perhaps good underlying themes attached to them? You know, you're going to have a much more better capability to capture value and generate wealth for you, even if it's just keeping in line with broader indices or broader pricing trends in equities than you are in fixed interest or the perhaps more complex alternatives investment area, whatever that may entail. By all means, I have some gold. I think gold's great. It's an interesting diversifier. But a bit of cash is always sensible. And then there's property. You know, for me, a house is a place to live. But I can understand why people want to diversify again into that asset class. Absolutely fine. But I think if you're looking to build medium-term pension fund wealth, equities have to be the core.
Yeah, because you said at the midpoint of our conversation that you've got your portfolio consists of 100% of equities. So with regards to that, having you know the bulk of your wealth in equities, if there was one thing you would change about the investing landscape, Chris, what would that be?
So you know, apart from
you mentioned the spin and the. And all the rest of it earlier. I'm just thinking about the other aspects of it. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no problem. I'd say The other aspect I would change is this hope, really, that people acknowledge medium term there are sort of real proper opportunities in the world, and trying to get away from too much short termism, and trying to work out that if you could boil down an investment idea to a theme, what is it? And I think this is really important, because if you try and see through some of the spin and the mess and everything else, even in sort of general investment decision making, cut through to what is the, in essence, what is the real driver there? Do you like that theme or not? And as I say, for me, the attributes to like are things like pricing power, dividend and cash flow generation capability, and if you like, correlation with growth of populations, the rise of the emerging markets and everything else. And if you can just focus more on the longer term, focus more on that weighing machine element rather than the voting machine element,
yeah,
I think it stands you in good stead. We all know the voting machine is exciting. It's exciting to see shares plunge or rise 10, 15% a day. But honestly, it could turn into noise so quickly. Focus on that weighing machine element. Focus on the compounding capability within interesting businesses doing interesting things.
Yeah.
Of course, have something of a more opportunistic short-term nature to complement that. But yeah, in the core of your portfolio, go back to those first principles. Look for good companies doing good things. And I think you'll participate in the medium-term wealth sort of enhancement possibilities that the stock market offers.
Okay, that's a brilliant conclusion there. Thank you very much, Chris. Well, I've got one last question for you, if that's okay, if you're still
yes, okay.
All right, so my final question to you is, given the fact that you started very early reading the Daily Mail, and you know, that your dad allowed you to have a look at, and then you went quickly into university, did all of that, ran your own business, and now you're independent and freelance and got your consultancy, and you've not got as many meetings as you had, back sure, in the 90s and the 2000s. If you were starting out today as a freshman in investment, in investing, what would you do that you'd not considered or were unable to do back in the 80s and 90s?
So the biggest, not mistake I made, but what I didn't do quickly enough was moving to doing much more of my own research. And it sounds sort of terribly arrogant, I know, but honestly, the amount of time I must have spent in speaking or listening to other people pontificating about things, people from very expensive and well-tailored investment banks, et cetera, they were saying, of course, something of interest, and maybe it's influenced and helped me in different ways at the back of my brain somewhere. But honestly, in a matchup between the way you learn the most about an investment is by getting your hands dirty, and by an hour spent looking now, listening to a conference call, pacing through a regulatory statement or statements, etc., versus an hour sitting either listening to somebody else talk about it or reading a broker note or something like that. The difference between the former and the latter is just huge. And it took me, I think maybe I had to get it out of my system, but I spent far too much time in the early part of my career looking and pacing through all of this stuff. I used to take home reams of paper with me at the weekend and whatever. And honestly, I'd have done a lot better doing what I do now, which is getting through to that primary information and focusing so much more on that. And I'd say if I could have done that 5 years earlier than I did, I think I would know a lot more. I'd be an even better investor than I attempt to be today. And I'm sure I would have got better results, because I think there is such a big correlation. Because it's not so much, I think I would have identified more winners. Maybe I identified a few more winners, but I'd have importantly cut some of the losers more quickly. Because I wouldn't have been so much enthralled to this concept or that concept, or had sort of undeveloped ideas about something, when actually a close perusal of some of the company statements and data would have shown actually the inadequacies of my thinking and the fact that I needed to move out of that investment and consider something else. As always in investments, you know, it's not just the winners, it's the losers you've got to worry about.
Yes, very much so.
And that's what I've learned.
Okay.
That actually, it's, and this is why I'm so excited at many levels today. And for people listening in, why they, I think, should be excited about the world of investments, because the barriers, the information barriers have come crashing down. What was apparent 20 years ago is no longer apparent. The average buy and sell side institution, in my opinion, are hugely scared about the information revolution because they realize that individuals who are sensible and put a bit of time into it can make a difference and do not necessarily need their expensive services and can start thinking about doing it themselves. I look at the States and I look at some of the trends there, and it is it's well established there.
Yeah, it's getting more established.
And I think it's coming over here. I think, to me is hugely exciting. So that's what I've learned. But the good news is, I'm still young. I've still got loads of years. You are still very young.
I've still got
loads of years left in me. Yeah. So I'm really happy that I've learned those lessons now and can apply them going forward. Because guess what? I honestly say that I think this, my best investing years are ahead of me, and that excites me in a way I can barely express.
No, that's fantastic, Chris. I mean, I just love your candid honesty, because the whole point of this Conqueror's Corner for me is the fact that, you know, you as in industry investment veteran are saying, I am still learning. Listen, guys, I'm still learning. After all what I've done, I'm still learning. I still see my best years ahead of me. Now, everyone out there who's got 2 years experience are scared. Those guys out there with 35 years experience are scared. And they should be, because the whole point is that the more that we learn, the better we make of ourselves, whether it be with investing, whether it just be with, you know, with work. And I just love the fact that you've just thrown that in there at the end. Thank you ever so much for that.
No problem. Sure. I honestly believe it. I think that is the way it is. So the good news is you can always get better. If I stop feeling as if I wasn't learning anymore, then the best thing to do is quit the whole industry. Buy some mainstream investment product and retire. Honestly, I can't think of a more boring thing to do, but I hope it never comes to that. I've got a feeling that when it comes to the people, I'm going to be dragged away from my computer or whatever technological investment sort of information device that exists in the future, kicking and screaming in a couple of generations' time or so. But plenty of time before then.
Okie dokie. Chris, we're going to wrap there. I've absolutely loved speaking with you. It's been an absolute delight. Thank you for sharing all that information with LSE Share Talk and the Conqueror's Corner audience. I'll be publishing this within the next few days, and we'll continue speaking on Twitter, and DM me, and you can contact the team at any time you want to come back on to speak again, because it's been absolutely fantastic.
No, absolutely. It's been great to talk about things. I hope you found it useful, and good luck. The key is do your own investing. There's no shortcuts. Do your own investing is the key.
The growth of DIY Investor and research is going to be immense over the next 10 years. I completely agree with you on that count.
I agree, yeah. Very good. All right.
Thank you very much, chap, and I look forward to seeing you. That was Chris Bailey of Financial Orbit and Peter Higgins of Conqueror's Corner. Thank you very much, Chris. Speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.